I'm glad now to introduce you to Stephen Isorardi, who I just met and appears in all cases to be a true Renaissance man of Southern California. Stephen has a PhD in international relations, teaches music and African American culture in a school in North Hollywood, Oakwood School, and also at the Antioch University here. He is the author of the book Central Avenue Sounds about jazz in Los Angeles. And from that book came the 4-CD set that Rhino issued a few years ago devoted to Los Angeles jazz. He is also the co-author of several autobiographies, Horace Tapscott and Buddy Collette, and a saxophonist himself. So looking forward to hearing Stephen Isorardi, who's going to tell us about his oral history project of Los Angeles African Americans. Thanks.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to talk about jazz. I would like to actually talk about two projects, which are interrelated, where one has grown out of the other. And in a way, I guess most of us think of these projects as somewhat, I don't know if antidote is the right word, but certainly necessary supplement, at least, to the Ken Burns vision of jazz and how it evolved. Initially, the project, our first project was called Central Avenue Sounds, and it began in 1989, and it was an attempt to actually document the evolution of a community, the African-American community of Los Angeles, through its secular music tradition. And it was, we were working within oral history. There wasn't much in the way of documentation. There still isn't, although since then, since we began the project, sort of a few treasure troves of photos have made their appearance and things such as this, but not much else. So the only way to preserve this history, we concluded, was through extended life history interviews with musicians and other people who were part of that scene. Now, the Central Avenue scene in Los Angeles in the first half of the 20th century it really represented the heart of the African-American community. By day, it was a social, business, economic center of the community. By night, it was the cultural center. It was Los Angeles's Harlem, in a sense. It was a segregated community. It was segregated, as other peoples were in Los Angeles, through restrictive housing covenants. That's how it was maintained de jure in Los Angeles, and that lasted until the late 40s. When the Supreme Court struck restrictive housing covenants down. What we did over a period of 10 years, from 1989 to 1999, was essentially interview 37 people who were part of that scene in extensive life histories. The result of that, the tapes, I would bring the cassettes back to UCLA and then they would master them onto longer lasting archival tapes where they are being preserved under, I think, the best circumstances. My side of this is sort of the interviewing in the field, researching side. It's not the technical side. They would also generate transcripts of every interview, which is the reason, actually, that I was impressed with the program and decided to do this project with them. They generated bound transcripts. I have a sample if anyone would like to see. Each transcript emerges like this. It's word for word. There's a table of contents. There's an index, which makes it so useful for research. And the story that I think emerges through much of our work is the vibrancy of this community, the artistic, the cultural vibrancy of it. One of the themes that especially struck me, and that is sort of driving the current project I'm involved in, is the community arts focus that becomes somewhat prominent in the late 1960s, certainly. But I think really has its roots in communities like Central Avenue during this period of segregation. And one of the lessons that many of the musicians drew from that experience was sort of the importance of the arts in the community, and also the way the importance of the community in shaping them as artists. And this was especially the case with a man named Horace Tapscott, who I'll spend actually most of my presentation talking about. Horace was part of the Central Avenue scene. He arrived in 1943 from Houston as a 9-year-old. And what he found when he got to Central Avenue was a rather extraordinary support system, if you will. He found not only important music programs within the schools, elementary, junior high, and high schools. And in Los Angeles, that meant if you were an African American in the 1940s, you went to Jefferson High School and you were fortunate enough to meet an amazing music teacher named Samuel Brown, who trained over a few decades dozens and dozens of people who went on to quite wonderful careers in music, and who spent not only classroom time with kids, but would have special classes before and after school, would visit the family homes, would introduce them to people who could foster their career, private teachers and others. So you had a support system like this. You also had, at that time, a black union on Central Avenue, the local of the American Federation of Musicians. At that time, the AF of M was segregated, for the most part, with the exception of a few locals. And the black local on Central Avenue wasn't simply a business operation. It was a community institution. It was a social high point of the community. And it was especially this for the youngsters who were coming of age, who were interested in music, who could hang around this old wooden two-story building, sit on the stoop outside, and pretty much meet all of their heroes. Because all the musicians would go through the union. It was a place to hang out. There were rehearsal rooms, etc. So if you were an aspiring musician, you could sit on the stoop and you could meet Louis Armstrong or Lester Young or Duke Ellington and his band whenever they were in town. You could hear them rehearsing. In Horace's case, Duke invited him as a youngster, pre-teener, to come upstairs to the rehearsal room and sit in on one of the rehearsals. Just sit in and listen. Put him next to the trombone section. Wonderful opportunity. So your heroes were very accessible because they couldn't live anywhere else. They couldn't stay anywhere else. So that, on the other hand, that also fostered, especially for the younger kids, a tremendous love of the music and a closeness to those. And it was also a way, because friendships were formed, a way of transmitting the culture then and the knowledge to the next generation. Plus you had strings of clubs, some of which went all night long, many of which went all night long. So you had this tremendous support apparatus. And the conclusion that a number of those kids drew, such as Horace Tapscott, was of the vital importance of the arts within the community and the importance of being in your community in terms of shaping your arts and the effect that that can have. Horace, when he returned to Los Angeles after a few years in the Air Force, went on the road for a while, Lionel Hampton, and then faced a life choice. And the life choice was what he was going to do, what he was going to do in music. Was he going to continue on the road with Lionel Hampton, sort of on the jazz escalator up? He was also arranging for the band, etc. But he felt after 2 years of that it just wasn't making a point. He wasn't achieving what he thought he should achieve. He felt the music was getting more and more marginalized, in a sense, commercialized especially. And one morning in early 1961, as they were about to go on the road again, he walked on the bus, turned around and got off and walked back home and decided that he was going to commit his life to being an artist within his community. And by the end of that year, he started putting the pieces together for a community band. It was later to be called the Pan-African People's Orchestra. And that still survives, and which he maintained until his death in February 1999. The purpose of doing this was to interact with other musicians within the community, to provide a forum for their music and their own music, to provide a school and an opportunity to perform for the generations coming up. It was also a way to bring music to the community. And his attitude was, if you're going to make the arts a part of everyday life, which he felt they should be, that you don't sit around waiting for gigs, you don't get managers, you don't wait for contracts. You simply go out and you do it. And so the purpose of the band, as soon as they felt they were ready, was simply to go out and perform wherever they could. They'd go into parks where there was a band shell, they'd simply set up and play. At one point, somebody gave them the use of a flatbed truck. So they put the band on the back of a flatbed truck. They just pull up at intersections and play. They played at churches. They played at various cultural venues and community institutions. They played for all sorts of activists and many causes. Their only criteria for performance was whether or not they felt these people who were organizing the activity were doing something positive in the community. That's all they asked. So they would perform for everyone from the Nation of Islam to the Black Panthers to us to church groups to political figures, Tom Bradley in his early years of his campaigning, they would perform for and many others. And their criteria was always, are they doing something positive? Once a politician got elected, if they never showed their face again in the community, they severed all ties and would no longer play for them. So that was the attitude that Horace brought to his community. And it was also, I think what he did achieve over 30 or 40 years was to forge a kind of community aesthetic, feeling that as an artist, you can not only impact your community, you not only hold up, as it were, a mirror to your community of what was happening, of what the problems were, what the issues were, but also as an artist, if you were on the scene, if you were part of it, if you weren't just giving a talk and then going back up into the Hollywood Hills, that your own art would be affected by that and reflect that. And there were many artists who were acting on, I think, these values then. Some such as visual artists or assemblage artists, Noah Purifoy and John Atterbridge, who in 1965, in August of 65, walked down 103rd Street as sort of the embers were still warm and literally gathered debris over a couple of days, filled their garages with it, and then created extraordinary sculptures. Horace, in a sense, reflected that aesthetic also. His attitude was, many of his compositions are very complex metrically, they're very difficult. And when asked why his compositions were this way, was this an intellectual exercise? Were you just trying to see how complex you could make things or whatever? He said, no. He said he would pick up his rhythms by watching for patterns on his block and the community around him. He'd watch the way certain people walked. He'd listen for sounds. And it's this that would inspire him and that he would try and write. He said, I could write about red roses just like anyone else, but what interests me more is the soil that the roses are growing in. And so in that sense, he created a body of work and I think inspired many generations of artists to create music that I think could truly be said to be authentic. And also people who saw the arts as something much more than simply getting gigs, signing contracts, and writing to spec. What I'm engaged in now is trying to preserve as much of this legacy as possible. And actually, before I talk about that, I'd like to show you a little bit of Horace in performance. This is a recital he gave at Philharmonic Hall in Berlin in 1988, and it's one of his compositions called Mothership. Unfortunately, I don't know what generation tape this is. As someone committed to his community and not caring especially much about what the commercial world thought one way or the other, there isn't a lot of very professional documentation of Horace's work, so we get what we can. Horace, what were you doing? Well, that's a taste of Horace. I think his greatest legacy is at the back of his autobiography. There's a list of some 200 to 300 names of individuals, musicians, poets, writers, dancers, who over a 40-year period moved in and out of the orchestra. And that's quite an extraordinary achievement to impact that many people. And I know that list is not complete. as for our next project, when Horace and I had our last taping session for his autobiography, we talked about where to go from there, and decided that the most obvious thing seemed to be a history of the Pan-African People's Orchestra and the related organizations that grew up around it, such as UGMA. Unfortunately, Horace got sick about 2 months later, but even from bed, he was setting up the first interviews, and we promised it would get done. So for the last 3 years, I've done about 100 interviews so far with people who were part of the orchestra and UGMA. But most significantly, the challenge we're facing now is his archive. And a few months ago, I got a real shock when we walked into his battered garage and found literally hundreds and hundreds of tapes. Box after box of reel-to-reels, cassettes, some professional recording tapes, the earliest going back to 1960. And I've spent the last few months compiling what is now an 80-page list of the tapes that we could identify. There's a couple of boxes of cassettes without enough identification to make sense of them. But on the whole, it strikes me that this is one of the most extraordinary documents of a community arts movement that I know of. The first 20 years or so, 1960 to 1980, are reel-to-reels. There was a historical consciousness amongst the people around Horace, and people were writing on the reel-to-reel boxes, dates, personnel, notes, compositions performed, things like this, which certainly made my life much easier. The cassettes posed a bit of a problem. there wasn't as much writing, but there was some documentation. But the big problem we're facing now is preserving what are literally, I don't know how many, we haven't done a count, but hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tapes, easily in the thousands, I think, in the lower thousands. Some of the reel-to-reels, I think there's only one I've come across with some mold, but most of them, a lot of the early ones, you can tell, are getting a bit brittle, so we don't dare play any of them. Even though we have such tantalizing things as a reel-to-reel from 1964, which features Horace's quartet, and one of his most important members of the orchestra there was a saxophonist named Arthur Blythe, some of you may know of. And they played this gig one night, which features some speakers, H. Rapp Brown and Bobby Seale. And this was in 64, a few years before Seale co-founded the Black Panther Party, and a little bit before the phrase Black Power became widely in the use. But I think as a whole, this is potentially an extraordinary documentation, even given the fact that probably the quality of a lot of the tapes is not very high and were probably very amateurishly done. And then there are cabinets and cabinets of sheet music. Part of Horace's aesthetic was to encourage everyone who came around the band to write music. And if they had sounds but they didn't have skills, they would create classes and give people musical rudiments so they could write. And there was a lot of this sheet music. And one of our goals is not only to organize the music and try and track down missing parts and scores, but hopefully to put together a band book, a collection of some of the most important scores, and circulate that throughout the music programs in local schools. And then hopefully, if we can get enough funding, provide for some of the musicians to come and perform the pieces as well. So that's our long-run goal. Immediately, we'll get a history of the orchestra out. But the archival issues that we're facing now are pretty big, and we shall see what happens. So if anyone has any advice, any tips, please feel free to chat. Any questions? No, it's right now it's in Horace's garage, where it's been since he moved there in 1966. There's been one meeting with the family and people from the UCLA Music Library and Special Collections Department. I don't think the family's made a decision yet, but they certainly are aware that this has to go somewhere where it can be preserved. One of the interesting things I found in my research, Larry and I were chatting about this earlier, is that one of the things that emerged in the 60s was a real heightened consciousness of preserving the history. It was a very important part of the movements then. And I've found and met many people, given my area of research, throughout the African-American community who were savers, who've collected things. I've run into individuals not affiliated with any institutions, but were part of the scene, were involved in various groups, and saved things. So in a sense, I think the big issue that's facing us is finding ways to connect with individuals and community organizations who have substantial archives and collections, and connecting with them to help them preserve and also to help them find places where this material can be treated and guaranteed to live beyond their lifetimes. The issue doesn't seem to be so much material. I think that's out there and that's in collections. The question is the longevity, the preservation of it, and helping a lot of well-meaning people who have done wonderful preservation work so far, helping them find a way that, you know, it's going to survive their lives, you know, so their kids don't toss it in the garbage can. Yeah, like as with most things, there were one or two. There were more than a few. Horace and his quintet did a recording on a small Flying Dutchman label that Bob Thiel organized in 1969 called The Giant Has Awakened. It was a bad experience, and Horace just, he had to be convinced to do the recording session anyway. He was outvoted by the band, essentially what happened. And he just didn't trust the commercial world. He turned his back on it. And then in the late 70s, this, as he described it, this 6'4" blonde, blue-eyed German guy came walking down. As Horace said, he came walking down right in the middle of the hood where 6'4" blonde, blue-eyed guys didn't go. And he said, and he started showing up at performances. And finally, one day, he walked up to Horace, he said, I love your music, and this should be recorded, and, you know, I'll pay for it. This is a guy whose occupation was a bookie. That's how he made his money. He was good at it. And no experience with recording, didn't know anything, but he had a bankroll. So he went around town, found engineers, and he started this label called Nimbus Records, specifically to record Horace and other groups in the orchestra. And Tom Albach still operates the label. He's in Albuquerque now. And he has closets full of material. He has issued early on a few orchestra recordings, and he's done so far 9 solo albums of Horace. But he's got about 24 hours of Horace playing solo in his closet. He's issued about 7 hours of it. He would take Horace, he'd drive up to Santa Barbara. In the middle of the night, they would get the Libero Theater here in Santa Barbara. Tom would rent it. He'd put Horace on stage at a piano. They'd turn all the lights off. Tom would sit in the back row, and then he had an engineer, Dennis Moody, out in a truck recording. And they just he'd just turn on the tape, and Horace would play for hours. And they did that a number of times. So he still has all that stuff in his closet. But that's how much of the recording has come. There have been a few commercial recordings since then with, you know, some labels here and there, but not a great deal. So I guess I'm past my time, so thank you.
There seemed to be some surprise here. I would think being a bookie is about 75% of the qualifications you need to run a record label, but it's my own opinion, I guess.